Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Perla Bataya. Bataya released the album A Letter to Leonard Cohen in late 2024. It's her second collection of Cohen compositions, with some other material in there as well. She sang with Cohen starting in the late 1980s and remained a close friend up until the time of his death in 2016. In this conversation, she recalls their first meeting, the complicated process of making this new album, and Cohen's sense of humor. That's on Into Music, coming up now. It's great to be speaking to you about this record. I absolutely love it. And I think it's appropriate, of course, to talk about your relationship with Leonard Cohen. So how did the two of you first become acquainted? Were you aware of his music, or was this just something where you met professionally? Or
this was the late 80s. You know, Jennifer Warrens had that record out about Leonard Cohen songs, and I was aware of that. And in my mind, I remember some of the early, I remember Judy Collins did Suzanne and those, that I associated with Leonard Cohen, but honestly, I didn't know much about him. And then I got a phone call one day when I, you know, pretty much was depressed about the music business and thinking my life was over in my mid 20s, couldn't do this rock thing. You know, I'd been in a rock band, we were going to tour, and then it was so loud and it was just a different lifestyle than I knew that I wanted, you know, like a lot of drinking, a lot of those things that I was not that kind of person. So anyway, I was fired from that gig and devastated and thought my life was over. And my father, surprisingly, who never talked to me about anything, just calmly said, calm down, you know, something better is coming. And literally the next day, I got a phone call from Leonard Cohen's musical director saying, you know, we're looking for a singer. We've been auditioning for weeks. Would you come in and audition? And I just said, and I hated auditioning, but I just said, you know, okay, what do I have to lose? And he said, well, it's for Leonard Cohen, and he's got a new record, and we're going to tour Europe, and this is the plan, so come tomorrow. And I said, should I prepare something? He said, no, don't prepare anything. We just want to see how you are with learning parts. There's a lot to learn in a couple of weeks before we go. And so, I went to Tower Records because I didn't know who Leonard Cohen was, really. So I raced to the record store and got as many cassette tapes as I could find. You know, this was the 80s after all. So I thought to myself, wow, this is like real art. These are lyrics with substance and unafraid to talk about the human condition. I just loved it. It just felt so courageous to me, that level of artistry. And being someone that was raised in a Spanish-speaking household, you know, I'm used to lyrics that are profound and moving and about, you know, love and loss and just the real deep stuff. So I was kind of excited. I was excited to meet this guy, first of all, you know. And I listened to the songs and I let that dictate, like, what I was going to wear. You know, that's important. What are you going to wear? So I thought about it. I totally felt centered. I arrived at the audition and Roscoe Beck, the musical director, said, well, Leonard wants to meet you first. He always just likes to meet somebody, get a feel for who they are, whatever. And I said, yes, I love that. Again, very Latin American thing. You always meet people, you greet them, everyone in the room before you do anything. So I love that. And, you know, I see this figure walking down the hall toward me and he's dressed all in black from head to toe. And I am dressed all in white from head to toe, like down to my boots, I was wearing white. And he takes my hand as he gets closer to me, very gently takes my hand, and he said, "Darling, we are a match made in heaven." And you know, from there, the audition was a dream because I loved the music. And I'm very fast. And I also, I'm someone who considers, you know, backing vocals a real art. So I jumped right in. And the other singer was Julie Christensen, who she and I had been in some jazz groups together and sang very complicated things. And we had this gift with one another that we never had to really discuss what we were doing. We just sort of danced around each other harmonically when we did these backing vocals. And I think Leonard, of course, got it right away that this little union was very special.
I just want to say that you know, this is sometimes unusual, because sometimes if you're brought into audition, you might not meet the artist. The MD might just deal with you and then say, yeah, they're in. And then you might not even meet the artist until first gig or something.
Oh, I could write a book about auditions, the worst auditions ever. I auditioned for the Beach Boys when I was like 19 or something. Not the Beach Boys. Brian Wilson was going on a tour. And this was the era where his life was being run by a psychiatrist or his doctor. And I auditioned for that guy, the doctor. And it was creepy. I never saw Brian Wilson. And he said, "Okay, sing me your song." And then and I was like, you know, and it was all over the news, you know, who this guy was and that Brian Wilson was going to be going back out on the road. But it was one of the most like, and honestly, he said, "You know, why would you choose that song for an audition?" And I wanted to say, "How would you know what a good audition song is? I don't really understand." But yeah, that was one of the creepiest auditions I had ever been to. And there are lots more like that. So this was actually, I have this feeling, I do in my life, honestly, feel like, you know, there are things that I am fated to do. Like, and it felt very much like that. Leonard and I were destined to meet. And immediately I just held him in such high regard. I mean, everyone did, but we met on a level that I think we bonded immediately, and I knew we were gonna be friends forever. He has this love for the Spanish language like I do, and he credits, you know, the reason he's a poet is because of his love for Federico García Lorca from, you know, Spain. And Spanish was my first language. So, and of course I sing in Spanish as well. So I have this deep love of it. And when we were in Spain, Leonard would ask me to translate everything he said to the audiences in Spain. And I said, "Well, don't get too fancy, because, you know, my Spanish is like, I'm okay, but I really grew up my parents making us assimilate really fast, you know, both immigrants saying, you're going to speak English and you're going to represent the whole family and you're going to speak English." And so, you know, my Spanish was pretty rusty, but he would make me translate, and I would translate things. And then he would say, you know, to me, you know, to say to the audience, "Please forgive me that I don't speak Spanish. It is my great, you know, embarrassment to not address you in Spanish, but I'm not so stupid that I wouldn't choose a beautiful woman to translate for me." And he's making me say all this to the audience, and I'm just going, and so his approach as a friend was to try to embarrass me as much as he possibly could and just make me laugh constantly.
Wow. So this is maybe something too, that I think, because there is so much weight so often to the songs, and of course the gravity of his voice, that he would be such a funny person.
He was hilarious. And honestly, you know, being that I've lived with this material for so long, I mean, what is it now? I got this job with Leonard in 1988. And then, you know, I just consumed as much Leonard Cohen and his poetry and his lyrics, that it's a little bit of an obsession of mine, that I get the humor in those lyrics. Even the darkest of dark, there's hilariousness happening constantly throughout his lyric, you know. Yeah, and I appreciate humor more than anything. I often say that, you know, my husband, you know, chose him to spend my life with, and we have a really great partnership and a delightful marriage, so fun still after, you know, 34 years, that I chose him, you know, not because he was handsome, not because he could cook, and I really appreciate a great cook, but because he was funny. And as a kid, I grew up in Santa Monica, and, you know, my family, very poor family, but in Santa Monica, those were the days everyone mixed together. So I get to high school, the rich, the poor, everybody kind of hung out, and it was a united sort of melting pot of people. When I was in high school, I met the most amazing kids that were my friends, who had phenomenally talented and interesting parents. So I kind of gravitated toward the interesting parents, and we became friends. And these were actors, directors, you know, Mel Brooks was part of that, and the Reiners, Rob Reiner and his dad, Carl Reiner. So these guys, and I was a kid, you know, 15, 16, 17 year old kid hanging out, just wanting to sit there and listen to their stories. Listen to the day, you know, the days in New York, the days here. I was just swept away by the humor of it all. You know, they were so funny, and there was a real art to it. So I love that, and I gravitated towards that. And that is really one of the reasons that Leonard and I had such a lovely friendship, was that also that he was constantly just trying to make me laugh.
So you start with him in 1988, and you're going, you mentioned going abroad, and was this kind of a time where, you know, what was kind of his status in the U.S.? Was there a lot of work in the U.S. or was it mostly overseas?
He had, you know, we were rehearsing in this tiny little rehearsal studio in West L.A. and we get to Europe, and my first time going to Europe. So we get to Europe, and it's the I'm Your Man record had just come out. He is a mega star there. We are singing in stadiums and in, you know, bullfighting rings. And they're just sort of piecing together these venues to accommodate the crowds. And he would be swarmed on the street for autographs. He was a big, big star. And then we'd go to English speaking countries, like, you know, in England, and he was revered in Spain. And also this is where, you know, Take This Waltz was on I'm Your Man. So Spain was insane. And Germany and those other countries that, I don't know, it was phenomenal. And then we get to London, and also Royal Albert Hall, three nights at the Royal Albert Hall. But the writers, and this is what I still remember this, and I might've saved even some of these clips, you know, they love to dig into the, oh, he's depressing, you know, oh, the Prince of Darkness, you know, they just would keep that rhetoric going. And of course, my take on that was always, oh, they're just so stupid, or they haven't really, you know, dug deep, or they don't get it. Basically, it's just too much for them. And we get to the States, and oh my gosh, you know, go from staying in these, you know, 5-star hotels and being treated like royalty, we get to the States and we're playing tiny little theaters and staying in really crappy hotels. And even like in San Francisco in particular, we were playing, you know, it was a beautiful theater. It was like the Berkeley, there's a theater at Berkeley that we played, but the hotel we stayed at was like in the Tenderloin. And these were the days when it was really scary to stay in the, I didn't, never left my hotel room. And also American journalists didn't get Leonard. And this is what's so interesting, because, you know, as a singer, and someone that loves a great lyric and poetry, you know, I love to listen to poetry. I love to go to Shakespeare plays. I mean, language is a very big deal for me in my life. I never understood why journalists, you know, who are about language, would kind of diminish who Leonard was as an artist by just saying, oh, it's gloomy or whatever they chose to call it, and not seeing the absolute genius in his lyric. Because it, obviously, you know, as time has gone on, he will live forever. And I do compare him to Shakespeare a lot, because Shakespeare will live forever. And you see, you hear, Judi Dench just wrote a book about Shakespeare. I think she called it the guy who pays the bills or something like that, because Shakespeare has been her life. You know, she attributes all of her success to that life of Shakespeare, of being in the theater. And a lot of times with reading this book, she will say, oh, just get on with it. You know, it's all there in the lyric, in the Shakespeare. But for me, it's all there in the lyric.
It's interesting to me, the European connection, because it's kind of funny, because I knew Famous Blue Raincoat, and I'd seen John Cale, you know, of Velvet Underground fame, live. And of course, he had recorded Hallelujah. So I knew a couple of songs, but it really was, I was living overseas in 2001, 2002, and Everybody Knows was being played everywhere. My friends over there knew so much about Leonard Cohen, and they were just like conversing about him. And I'm like, how do I not know?
Well, you know, we also, I mean, you know, during that period of time in the US, it was a very interesting time, musically speaking. Remember, we had like global music was sort of taking over. We had a really great mix. So it was very exciting here, having Peter Gabriel and having like the African stuff that Paul Simon was doing. I mean, artists were doing really, really interesting things. So I think in the States, where, you know, and we are arguably or have been, I don't know if anymore, but the cradle of this creative explosion, for lack of a better term, for music in particular. Everyone wants to make it in America. But interestingly enough, you know, when I went out on the road with Leonard, and the Europeans just embraced this, because it's still about language there and art. I still feel that art is way more supported in European culture than it is here. You know, when schools are forced to come up with money or try and raise money to even have an art program, that it's not considered something that has to be part of the curriculum here. I can't wrap my head around that. But in Europe, it's part of the curriculum. Everyone, especially, I spent a lot of time in Spain, and everyone plays an instrument. Everyone writes poetry. Everyone, you know, is a painter or an artist of some kind. And that's kind of where people sort of meet. That's the place. That's the, you know, the foundation where you build a relationship from. It's art and music, and the people that hang out in the streets and drink coffee and talk to each other. And there's a lot of common ground there in the art world. And that's a constant discussion, which is very interesting to me. So I got why, you know, Leonard was so popular there. And Leonard did become very popular here in the States, but not until there was a story, the story of him losing all his money and his manager stealing it all, that sort of captured the imagination of the North American audience. And all of a sudden, you know, Leonard Cohen on his deathbed is like a superstar in the States. So that's an interesting fact, I think.
So ultimately you joined in 1988, and then how long does this run last with him?
We did another record, The Future, in 1993, and we toured that all over Europe and the US. So those were the big tours with Leonard. And then after that, he seemed to be losing faith in the music business, because I also think for him, he did want to leave some kind of, you know, legacy of success here in the States. That didn't quite happen. And I remember a phone call from Leonard one day when he said, you know, darling, I've decided the music business has changed so much. I sold my catalog. And I said, wow. And he mentioned this amount of money. And he said, yeah, I will never see that in my life. And I said, well, great, Leonard. You know, he already didn't own Hallelujah. I think he had sold that a while ago. So he was really happy with this. And the people that bought his catalog, all of a sudden, or I think Hallelujah was part of that catalog. And Hallelujah then became a hit because Disney put it in Shrek. And then everyone and his cousin is singing Hallelujah. And I remember Leonard saying to me, you know, it's not even one of my better songs. And it's the smash hit of the world. And people are singing it at weddings, you know. I thought that was very funny.
I'm curious about this because I think he, like Bob Dylan, they wrote these songs that translate very well to the feminine voice, to the woman's voice, and the stories translate across gender lines. What do you think that, for him, that thing is that makes that so?
A good song is a good song. You know, a good song is a good song. And I don't put a lot of, you know, I don't look at a song and say, oh, this is written for a man, therefore I can't do it or whatever. You know, and Leonard always gave me absolute permission to do whatever I wanted to do with the songs when I started recording Leonard Cohen songs. And also in concert, he never did all of the verses. He would choose whatever he felt like doing. And that was that, you know. But I honestly feel that a good song is a good song and anybody can sing it. Although I have to say, I don't know if you're familiar with Patrick Page. He starred in Hadestown originally in London and then on Broadway. He films, you know, did a film with Ryan Reynolds about the holidays. And then also he's on the Gilded Age television show. Anyway, he wrote me after I saw him in Hadestown. I just wrote him a little fan mail, you know, saying on Instagram or something, just going, oh my gosh, totally am blown away. Something about your voice reminds me of Leonard, you know, it's just the gravity and the love, it's very loving. And he wrote me right back saying, oh my God, I'm a fan. Let's talk. What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. So we just became like these pen pals on Instagram. And then I invited him to sing on my record, to sing on Democracy, because I had this idea that it was going to be a bit of a rap as opposed to just a song, that I really wanted to recite those lyrics. And my voice didn't have the gravity that I wanted to instill. You know, Democracy is coming to the USA. It's very immediate right now. And I felt I needed a voice that would drive home the message. And I felt like I don't have Leonard, but maybe Patrick would do it. And I just texted him and I said, Patrick, this is crazy, but I really want you to sing on Democracy with me. And, you know, I don't have a lot of money. I'm just a poor working stiff. If you will do this for me, you know, I'll be your friend for life. He said yes. And we recorded it. And Michael Elizondo, who is one of the most wonderful producers on the planet. He was my, you know, he was, I think my gig, he did my gig. He was bass player with me. I was his first gig out of high school. So I love this kid and he's gone on to be just this massive success. And, you know, I remember he would call me from Dr. Dre, snapped him up immediately because he was so talented. And he was all of, you know, 19 years old, going on the road with Dre, writing beats and, you know, to the songs Dre was writing. Dre gave him writing credit. So this kid became a real powerful force in the music business at an early age, but just a lovely, lovely human. So I called him and I said, Mike, I have this vision for Democracy and it's more of a beats track than anything else. Do you have time? Would you just help me with that? Or lead me to someone that can help me? He said, I have time. I have a couple of days before I get onto the next project. Let me add it. and he delivered a beautiful track. And yeah, things just kind of fell into place for this. And so where you're, you know, where you're saying that some of these songs lend themselves to male, female voices, you know, sometimes I think if you have in mind this effect you want to have, that's where you make the decision. You know, there are songs of Leonard's that I don't see myself singing yet.
This album, so what was the criteria for choosing the songs? Because you knew the music well. So was this something where it was like you had to have an emotional connection, or they were somehow personal beyond that?
Well, I've been touring in the US and Europe, Leonard Cohen material now for over 15 years. And it makes me so happy that people, they want this. And and Europe has been so incredible. And I have a group of musicians that I travel with who are from Barcelona. And we sort of chose Barcelona because we have a friend, Jackson Brown. He's so generous. He has a place there and he doesn't really ever go there. He's just so busy. He lets us stay there. So, I mean, you know, and so that kind of was the, that was our foundation. Okay, we have a place to stay. We won't go broke with hotel costs. And then I just looked for musicians and found this great group of wonderful Spanish musicians. And so we toured extensively through Europe. And they are very much like very excited about, oh, let's add this song, or what about this? And in rehearsal or in sound check, we'll introduce a new song and then we work on it. And so the songs kept coming to me, and it wasn't that I chose them. It was as though they chose me, frankly. It felt like, you know, there's a body of work that's already in here that I do regularly, but that I haven't recorded, but we kept touring and the repertoire kept growing. And while we're in the studio recording this record for the second time, by the way, the first one, all of my files were lost. And
oh no,
I had started recording like before COVID, right? And just sent money to the musicians to get in the studio and record the tracks. And then I would record my vocals here. COVID came and the person whose computer it was on lost everything. So I was deeply embarrassed because I felt I should have had a hard drive. There's a lot of shoulds. I should have done a lot of things, right? And I was so embarrassed. And after feeling so much shame about it, I just said to my husband, I think I just have to come clean, be really honest, and do a fundraiser to start over. That's all. And it was, you know, it was COVID. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll go back and I'll try to, you know, that's where I started the thought of let's at least listen to what we have. Well, it wasn't there. So the whole, you know, time was spent starting over. So I raised the money, thankfully, with many generous friends and fans who were so eager to help. And once the shutdown looked like things were going to open up again, we went to Barcelona, got a studio and started the process. And it was very difficult because what had happened during COVID was we all lost our minds. Everyone in varying degrees suffered a lot, lost people, went towards, you know, a little too much of everything, alcohol, whatever it is you gravitate towards. And I felt that I, you know, and I'm in the studio and the clock is a ticking and I was in a panic because of all the chaos. And, but we're all humans, we're all artists. And I switched gears after the panic and said, we're just going to get this down. We're going to get this down, panic and all. And then I came home and didn't listen for a while because I didn't want to relive those feelings. So I just kind of let that be. But it kept gnawing at me that I should do Democracy. And that's not something we recorded in the studio. It just kept, it was just in my head that I needed to do it. So I kind of put that aside, called Mike. We went into the whole thing about Democracy and got that done. And I was pretty happy about that. And then I thought, you know, there are lots of other things to do on it, backing vocals, you know, just continue the process. And then I went back to the record and was very happy kind of with this little edge of emotion it was real. Whatever's on there is real. And Jackson was generous enough to say, well, you know, go use my studio in Santa Monica for whatever you need to finish. And then I decided to write a song about my relationship with Leonard. And I wrote with my friend Deborah Holland, the L of your first name. Because a lot of people are so curious about my relationship. Everyone always wants to know, oh, well, did you sleep together? You know, and I, in the song, I think the point is that, you know, what we had was deeper than that. It was way more profound than that. And that's kind of what I wanted people to know. And then another song that I wrote is on the record, Awakened, which is about what he did for me, which was Leonard awakened the courage that I needed for that decision that I'm going to live my life as an artist. It takes a brave soul who doesn't come from money, who doesn't have a penny, to say, music, that's what I'm going to spend my life doing. I think about it now and I just go, wow, that's crazy. But I applaud people that do that. You know, I don't want to live in a world where only the wealthy can be the artists. I just don't. That's not saying that some wealthy people are not great artists. It's just saying that I think everyone should have an opportunity to express themselves and not just, you know, be struggling to keep your head above water and food on the table and then let everything fall by the wayside. All your creative things just die. And at the end of the day and at the end of your life, what are you going to say? Well, I paid my mortgage or I put somebody else through college and let them figure out all their dreams. You know, I truly feel like this is the only life that I have and I'm very happy with my choices.
I'm Jed Bodwin and you've been listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest has been Perla Bataya. Her latest album, A Letter to Leonard Cohen, is out now. You can learn more about her and her work at perla.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast at kmuw.org. And we do welcome your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.